context of COVID-19. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikavet Tafoy, the entire team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwa لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
Security sources say the Taliban have captured Lashkar Gah in southwestern Afghanistan following the takeover of Kandahar and Herat. The Australian capital enters a lockdown following the detection of a single COVID-19 case as Sydney reports its highest daily infections. Also ahead, flash floods and mudslides in northern Turkey leave at least 17 people dead and force thousands to evacuate their homes. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Taliban militants say they have captured Lashkar Gah, the capital of Helmand province in southern Afghanistan. A security source has confirmed the news, saying military and government officials had evacuated Lashkar Gah after striking a deal with the Taliban. The militants have seized at least 10 provincial capitals since last Friday as they press ahead with their offensive across Afghanistan. The group is estimated to be in control of nearly two-thirds of the country. The capital, Kabul, remains in the hands of the government. Thousands of civilians have already fled there as the Taliban took key cities one by one. Meanwhile, the US and the UK say they are deploying thousands of troops to help evacuate their nationals and diplomats leaving Afghanistan. The war between government forces and the Taliban militants in Afghanistan has prompted hundreds of thousands of Afghans to leave their homes in search of shelter. The displaced Afghans are now in urgent need of support as they spend days and nights in open sites. Amin Alami reports from Kabul.
Hundreds of thousands of local Afghans have fled their cities and villages in northern and northeastern provinces due to back-to-back collapse of most provincial capitals in the north and northeast to Taliban. Some displaced families have arrived in the capital, Kabul, and they have nowhere to go but the roadside or parks like the one here in central Kabul. That is why they welcome any move that could mitigate their misery. The advances have displaced more families across the country. Some displaced people accuse local officials of making secret deals with Taliban.
Our city fell to Taliban without any exchange of fire. The same story went on in Ghazni city,
where his governor was arrested by the NDS over handing over the city to Taliban. This proves that there are some secret deals behind the collapse of our cities.
The displaced Afghans urge warring sides to stop turning more cities into the battlefields by resuming a meaningful intra-Afghan negotiation.
We, the people of Afghanistan, are the main victims of war. We have lost all we had. Ceasefire is the only way to get out of the current crisis. The government and Taliban must sit for talks and resume a meaningful negotiation.
Afghan government has ordered the country's Ministry of Awqaf and Hajj to open the doors of all mosques in government-controlled areas for displaced families, and that the government is going to fully support them under close cooperation with the international humanitarian agencies. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Palestinian president strongly condemns Israeli plans to build over 2,000 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. President Mahmoud Abbas's office rejected the move, saying it contradicted the U.S. position of President Joe Biden, who expressed in a phone call with his Palestinian counterpart. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also condemned the move as aimed at grabbing more Palestinian land and consolidating Israeli settler colonialism. The regime's new plans come despite international condemnation against its settlement expansions. In July, a UN human rights investigator said Israeli settlement activity in the occupied West Bank amounts to a war crime. All Israeli settlements are considered illegal under international law.
In an attempt to blunt international opposition to Israeli settlement construction in the occupied territories, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is pushing through plans for more than 2,000 settler units in the occupied West Bank, and at the same time has decided, after long years, to grant a rare authorization for 836 Palestinian homes in Area C of the occupied West Bank. It's virtually impossible for Palestinians to get construction permits from Israeli authorities. Palestinians say Bennett is trying to deceive the world by the so-called equalization.
All this announcement is just to tell a fake message to the world that we are equalizing, and you know, so we give the Palestinian permissions. It's not true that we are destroying. This is like a wrong message that will be given to the international community. We should confront it as a Palestinian, and also international community should also confront that. This is a Palestinian occupied land, and Israel don't have the right either to build the settlements or to give the Palestinians in their homeland and a permission to build their houses.
Under the interim Oslo Agreement signed between the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Israeli regime in 1993, the West Bank was divided into three areas: Area A under Palestinian control, Area B under Palestinian and Israeli control, and Area C under full Israeli control, and this comprises some 60% of the occupied West Bank. Israel prevents Palestinians from constructing private or public buildings in Area C under different pretexts, such as using the land as military training zone, or it locates close to settlements, and other claims.
Israel is controlling Palestinians' lives in these areas. It prevents them from constructing new homes in their own lands. The new move is aimed at covering up Israel's future plans for new settlement projects in the Palestinian lands.
At the end of the day, it's almost impossible for Palestinians in Area C to get Israeli-issued building permits. Moreover, Israeli forces on a daily basis destroy and demolish Palestinian structures in the same area for lack of construction authorization, despite the policy deemed illegal by the international community.
Palestinians don't take Israel's new move seriously, saying what matters for Tel Aviv is to execute its plan known as Classified C Areas, which is aimed at putting an end to the presence of Palestinians on the mentioned areas. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Political commentator Bruce Katz says Israel wants to sugarcoat its land theft crime by promising Palestinians new homes in the new settlements.
What we're seeing, quite simply, is the attempt by Israel to try to complete the annexation of the West Bank, but by way of the back door. So they've even gone to the with the degree of promising the Palestinians 8,000 Palestinian homes, which is quite ironic. It's as if they're saying that, well, we continue to steal your land and property, but we will build you 1,000 homes on land that doesn't belong to us in the first place in order to sugarcoat the continued theft of the land. I do not expect that given the reality of the situation, I don't expect the Biden administration to make any great fuss about it. I think that basically Israel dictates what policies will take place in terms of new settlements.
Now, the leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, has put forward a new initiative with 9 points to tackle the humanitarian crisis in the war-torn country. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more in this report.
To show its goodwill to find a peaceful solution to the years-long crisis in Yemen, Yemen's Ansar Allah has put forward a new initiative with 9 points to tackle the current crisis.
The initiative put forward by the Ansarullah leader serves the interests of all Yemeni people. I believe it is an appropriate opportunity for all conflicting sides to get out of the current predicament and avoid military battles. With this initiative, Ansarullah reaffirms once again that it is keen on finding a political solution to the conflicts in Yemen.
The spokesman of Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abdul Salam, said the initiative includes stopping the Yemeni army's operations in Marib, reactivating the Marib gas station to generate electricity for all Yemen, and forming a joint administration from the people of Marib to maintain security and expel the terrorist groups from the city.
The initiative launched by Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi is aimed to stop war in Marib. The people of Marib should have the final say when it comes to their political fate. Meanwhile, the roads must be opened for the free movement of Yemenis. This initiative is an appropriate measure that will benefit the Yemeni people and establish a comprehensive political and economic solution to the current crisis.
The free movement of all Yemenis, Abdul Salam said, should be guaranteed, as well as the release of all the detainees from the presence of the Saudi-backed forces in Marib. Ansarullah's initiative came in conjunction with the UN's appointment of Hans Grundberg of Sweden as its new envoy for Yemen.
Many here say changing the UN envoy will not solve the problem because, as things stand, this is the US which controls the situation and leads the war on Yemen behind the scene. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Australia's state of New South Wales has reported its biggest daily rise of coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic. Officials warned that infections could surge in the coming days.
We had, unfortunately, 390 cases of community transmission. Some are still under investigation, but at least 60 of those have been infectious in the community. And I anticipate, given the large number of cases we've had in the last few days, that unfortunately this trend will continue for at least the next few days.
The authorities also reported 2 new deaths. They bring to 38 the total fatalities from the latest outbreak in New South Wales. The state's capital, Sydney, is the hardest hit. Infections have spiked there despite a nearly 7-week lockdown. The restrictions were imposed after a Delta-driven outbreak in the city in mid-June. The virus has even spread to other parts of Australia, prompting officials to impose similar curbs. On Friday, the capital, Canberra, entered its first day of a week-long lockdown after it reported 2 cases. The lockdown is the first there in more than a year. At least 17 people have been killed in flash floods in Turkey's northern Black Sea region. More than 1,300 people were removed to safety from the affected areas. The downpour also damaged power infrastructure, leaving about 330 villages without electricity. Turkey is grappling with a rapid succession of natural disasters. The torrential rains in northern stretches come as the country is battling some of the largest wildfires in its history across the southwest for nearly 2 weeks now. Five cities in the central Chinese province of Hubei have declared red alerts after torrential rains there left 21 people dead. Nearly 6,000 people have been evacuated. Chinese media say floods triggered by torrential rains have caused damage to over 2,700 houses and shops. Power, transportation, and communications have been disrupted too. Rescue crews have already been dispatched to the worst affected areas. China regularly experiences flooding during its wet summer months, but the authorities say extreme weather is now becoming more frequent as a result of climate change. Last month, Hubei's neighboring province, Henan, was hit by record rainfall and floods that killed more than 300 people. Iran, like many other countries in the world, has been gripped by the Delta variant of COVID-19. Deaths are mounting, as have infections. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stated that although foreign providers reneged on their promise, executives within Iran need to double their efforts to make sure the vaccines are developed and distributed domestically.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has highlighted the unreliability of foreign providers of COVID vaccines to Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei said foreign providers of the vaccines initially reneged on their promises and refused sales. But things began to change course after Iran successfully managed to produce jabs against the deadly virus at home. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks during a televised speech on Wednesday amid a deadly pandemic wave that has gripped the country. Fortunately, the production of vaccines within the country paved the path for the import of foreign shots as well. Whereas before that, foreign suppliers would renege on their promises despite having received the payments. The leader called on the executive bodies to double their efforts to procure vaccines, whether imported or domestically developed, and made them available to everyone.
We always have to look to the source of problems in the Middle East, and that is usually either the United States or Israel. In this case, I think we can see, or say fairly safely, that the United States is pressuring other countries not to sell vaccines to Iran in order to pressure Iran to re-enter the JCPOA. This is going to be a failed strategy, another failed strategy by the United States, which has never understood people's loyalty to their own government and has tried to bribe or intimidate countries to do the United States' bidding.
Ayatollah Khamenei hailed an initiative by President Ebrahim Raisi to set a one-week deadline for proposals on a comprehensive national response to the current peak of the outbreak. He said the response to the issue should be carefully weighed and any necessary measures adopted and enforced accordingly.
This is another example of that. By preventing other countries from selling vaccines to Iran, U.S. hopes that Iran will agree to concessions to rejoin the JCPOA. This simply isn't going to happen.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
vacation on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely, thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, staged his uprising to revive the Prophet's practice and confront evilness. He sacrificed his life and all his belongings to safeguard human values and spirituality. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, O people, this Hussein is the son of Ali. Recognize him. I swear by the one which my soul is in his hand, that he and his lovers and lovers of his lovers will be in paradise. Imam Hussein's aim of uprising was to safeguard the divine values and protect the traditions of the Prophet of Islam. He spared no effort to revive the forgotten values of Islam. That's why the Muslim scholars believe that Islam owed its foundation to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and survival to Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Ignorance and oppression had covered the Islamic rules like dust after the passing away of the Prophet. The martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his loyal companions removed this dust and demonstrated the real image of Islam. This is what we read in Ziyarat, or standard form of salutation to Imam Hussein. I bear testimony that you indeed maintained the prayer and enjoined what is good and forbade what is evil. Basically, enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil have a very high position in the culture of the Ahlul Bayt, or the progeny of the Prophet. Imam Ali, peace upon him, calls this obligatory act as superior to jihad, or a struggle in the way of God. He says, all good deeds and jihad in the way of God, before enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil, are like a drop before a turbulent and vast sea. Imam Hussein believed that he had to support Islamic values with all his being. His personality was the incarnation of steadfastness and freedom. He staged his uprising to show to mankind that he would never surrender to oppression under any circumstances. He would never compromise with the despotic and licentious rulers of Umayyad regime. He used to quote these words from his father, Imam Ali. The most unjust man is the one who promotes traditions of oppression in the society and destroys just traditions. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, had an iron will. In response to his brother, Muhammad Hanafiye, who had proposed some peaceful ways for him to avoid military confrontation with Yazid, the Imam said, my brother, if there remains no refuge and safe haven on the earth, I will never swear allegiance with Yazid, son of Muawiyah. In the sublime culture of Imam Hussein, humility and submission before untruth and injustice has no place. His word keeps resonating in the ears of history when he said, beware that the illegitimate brat, the son of the illegitimate brat, Ubaidullah, son of Ziyad, has forced me to choose one of the two, either death or humility. How humility is far from us. God, his apostle, the faithful, the chaste lapse, the valorous people, and the people of the noble world do not accept from us to prefer the obedience of the base to death with dignity. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, sacrificed his blood to dignify Islam and the school of the Ahlul Bayt. In Karbala, he depicted the picture of self-sacrifice and safeguarding the pristine Islamic values. His uprising caused wise people to become more aware of oppression and corruption. He made them move against injustice rather than being indolent and inactive. 2 years after the epic of Ashura, many people staged uprisings to avenge Imam's blood. For instance, Mukhtar Saqafi staged a great uprising whereby he killed many of the perpetrators of Karbala. In the contemporary era too, revolutions and movements have been staged through taking the pattern of Ashura and Imam Hussein's uprising. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, staged his uprising to expose the tarnished image of Islam that Yazid and his cohorts had depicted of this religion. He fought against Yazid knowing that he and all his 72 companions would be slain. He taught us that we should sacrifice whatever we have to preserve the divine values and God's religion.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ministry.
At dawn on Thursday, August 5, while we were safely sleeping in our beds, Israeli enemy planes sent its warplanes to terrorize us in South Lebanon. After a full day of mortar shells on Wednesday that were as close as 1 kilometer away from my village house, we woke up terrified a few hours later at dawn at the sound of air raids that shook the entire South. For the first time since 2006, thanks to the deterrence equation imposed by the Lebanese resistance that has been in effect for the past 15 years, Israel bombed an open uninhabited area near the town of Mahmoudiya between the districts of Jezzine, Marjayoun, and Nabatiyeh. Tel Aviv claimed it was a response to the firing of rockets from southern Lebanon towards northern occupied Palestine, while perfectly knowing it was not Hezbollah who fired those rockets. Hint, if it were Hezbollah, all of those rockets would have reached their targets. Hence, it was another resistance faction with humble capabilities who gave their all to support their brothers and sisters in Sheikh Jarrah, just as they did during the Sword of Al-Quds operation in May. Israel crossed red lines and violated the rules of engagement established since 2006. Israel was counting on the resistance to let it go and not respond to the raid. But as usual, Israel came out unprepared and in full surprise when they hit back with hard and precise retaliation from the Lebanese Islamic resistance. Hezbollah was able to reiterate the deterrence equation and the rules of engagement that govern the Southern Front against the Israeli enemy. The resistance benefited from the error of Israel's assessments, which estimated before its raid on open areas deep inside the south that the Lebanese economic hardships would allow the Zionist occupation forces to bypass these rules and equations. The Israeli error was based on a misunderstanding of how much the economic and financial challenges in Lebanon can influence Hezbollah's retaliation. This motivated Israel to persist in its response to the recent rockets that fell in the northern part of occupied Palestine, which allowed it to use the Air Force to bomb Lebanese lands in return, albeit with caution that it was not inhabited. Israel repeated the same mistake it made last May in the Palestinian arena, as it estimated that the resistance factions in the Gaza Strip would not intervene to protect the rights of Al-Quds Palestinian natives against constant Israeli aggression. Yet Operation Sword of Al-Quds rained retaliatory fire on Israel, which ended with a large basket of losses to Tel Aviv. As a result, Hezbollah asserted its defensive equation in the face of Israel, clarifying the latter's limitations and emphasizing them. Meanwhile, Israel suffered a loss that is not without negative repercussions on strategic levels regarding its defensive and offensive stances on the Lebanese front. Although the results of what happened are not necessarily limited to Lebanon, but also extends to all regions of confrontation. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In a dangerous development for the security scene in South Lebanon, Israeli warplanes launched two raids at dawn on Thursday, August 5th, on the Damascus area in the outskirts of the town of Mahmoudieh between the districts of Jezzine, Merjayoun, and Nabatieh. The two raids targeted uninhabited areas, but Israeli media claimed it was the area from which rockets were launched the day before, targeting Kiryat Shmona illegal settlement in occupied Palestine. Now, although the Israeli placed a raid in the context of responding to rockets fired towards Palestine, yet the attack crosses all the red lines which are established by the rules of engagement in South Lebanon since the end of the July War 2006. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Radwan Murtada, veteran journalist at Lebanese Al-Akhbar newspaper. Thank you very much for being with us. So, Mr. Radwan, what if Hezbollah did not respond to abolish the new equation that the enemy tried to impose on the Lebanese arena? What is the extent of the next Israeli aggression had Hezbollah not retaliated to this one?
Experiences with the Israeli enemy have proven that if they strike and they were not stricken back, I mean, for retaliation, they would repeat so. In the past, the Israeli enemy used to say that they could occupy Lebanon with a musical band, and every time they had the chance, they would strike Lebanon. And these strikes went on up till the occupation of the capital, Beirut, in 1982 invasion and settling in more than one area in Lebanon. But with the experience of the resistance, this formula has changed. The resistance has established a deterrence equation that if you strike us, if you hit us, we're going to hit you back. This was more established after the July 2006 war. There was the war of the Israeli withdrawal 2000 and then the 2006 war. And what was produced and what resulted from this war, so the equation was as such that if you hit open land, you do the same. And now, if you kill one of our civilians, we'll kill your civilians. If you kill one of our freedom fighters, we will kill your group. So that was the experience when the Israeli enemy had a convoy of the resistance within Syria. Two martyrs were killed, and then Sayyid Nasrullah, Hassan Nasrullah, made a speech that we will let the Israeli enemy stand on one leg and a half, and they will have to wait for our retaliation.
So sometimes they used the effigies in order to make Hezbollah believe that these were troops. But
what Israel did is it repeated the mistake it did last May in the Palestinian arena. It repeated it the same on Lebanon when it estimated that the resistance factions in Gaza will not be retaliating to support their brothers and sisters of Sheikh Jarrah. Are these errors the results of maybe defects in the structure of the intelligence analysis and the assessment models of the Israeli intelligence establishment? And how will this affect the Israeli future engagement, whether in Lebanon or elsewhere?
Certainly, there was a mistake and miscalculation, misassessment, if you will, as for the reaction due to the sword of Al-Quds. The Israelis waged a war against Gaza and they failed. They lost that war. If you go back to the comments of the Israeli army or the analysts who are close to the Israeli army, no. The first they confirmed that there was a mistake, there was a wrong assessment, and these analysts who are usually close to the Israeli army usually avoid to criticize directly the Israeli army, but this time they did. You have Lilach Shuval, and she's one of the analysts who are close to the Israeli army. She says that once again it turned out that the Israeli assessment was wrong. First they assessed that Hezbollah will not retaliate to the Israeli attack on South Lebanon, and they did everything in order not to draw a blowback from Hezbollah. There was a comment from by Little Bram. He says that the assessment was that Hezbollah will not retaliate, in retaliation on the Israeli attack and retaliation to the Palestinian groups. So therefore, Israel was not ready to receive those missiles. So this scene demonstrates that there is a confusion. But Hezbollah has re-established this
But what will situation. Exactly be the repercussions for Lebanon in the event that Israel increases its aggression and maybe starts a confrontation in parallel with the economic and financial hardships right now in Lebanon that would ignite further the Lebanese public? And by the way, these hardships are ignited in Lebanon by, not to say maybe friends of Israel, but at least people who are pro-Israeli policies against Lebanon.
First of all, I would have a reservation as for the term friends of Israel. This was the case when there was the Lahad army, the SLA. Today, now we have parties that may disagree as for the issue of the friend of Israel and the enemy. Who is the friend and who is the enemy? What is taking place in the field has a political dimension. The evidence to what I'm saying is the visit by the Israeli war minister, Benny Gantz. So he wanted the French to use the crisis, economic crisis in Lebanon, and to have a condition in order to provide Lebanon with assistance that Hezbollah needs to stop the precision missiles that they are Hezbollah is developing. So they thought that Hezbollah is preoccupied with all these crises, and also there was an environment that is criticizing Hezbollah and are turning against Hezbollah. But it turned out that you have to take into account that Hezbollah does not represent all of the resistance. There were other groups of resistance. They offered martyrs in this regard. So would this lead to a further attack? Possible, but every strike will be met with another. This is what was affirmed by Hezbollah, Said Nasrallah.
Will Lebanon be able to intake such a blow by Israel within the event of the economic hardships?
First, the Israeli army was clear because they were sort of justifying the Hezbollah's action, that they were saying that there were no Israeli civilians fell, and such war they know that it's a lost war. They had this the experience of the sword of Al-Quds war, and in spite of all the siege that is imposed on the Gaza people, so they, how can they engage with Hezbollah who has more armed, has no siege against it, and has a huge amount of 150,000 rockets, and also the expertise that was Hezbollah achieved in Syria. So I think that the Israeli enemy will not dare to engage in war against Lebanon.
Well, I want to thank you, Mr. Murtada. Please stay with us. We will keep talking about this matter in the second segment of the show, and please stay tuned. We will have more to talk about the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. Now, Israel was counting on the resistance failure to respond to its first raid since 2006. The Israeli assessment was based on its theory that Hezbollah is deterred as a result of various factors, most notably the stifling economic crisis in Lebanon and the internal political conditions. However, the resistance surprised the enemy and fired dozens of missiles towards open lands near enemy positions in the occupied Sheba farms. Israel was again deterred. Now, the highly complex equation is very simple at the same time, and the result is that the resistance has re-established its red lines. It is forbidden for the occupying army to attack Lebanese territory, and the enemy should not bet on the resistance preoccupation at home or on its deterrence. Israel retreats in Lebanon in this following report.
Last week, Israel seemed to be at war with itself over the narrative that it wanted to deliver to its audience, with a mission that aims to reduce the possible losses it sustained after Hezbollah's missile response, leading to Israel's retraction. In contrast to the noticeable political silence with zero threats, which are usually a prerequisite for the official Israeli approach to any confrontation, the Israeli occupation forces spokesman Ran Kohav was busy trying to demonstrate what he referred to as, quote, indications that Hezbollah is not interested in a confrontation with Israel, unquote, adding that Israel is, wait for it, studying appropriate ways to respond to Hezbollah's retaliatory strikes, then stressing that, quote, all parties do not want war. Yep, he said that. Ran said that Israel, the same Israel that carpet-bombed Gaza 3 months ago, does not want war. The reaction of Israel's leaders, both political and military, following Hezbollah's missile response to the enemy's air raid at dawn on Thursday, August 5, was remarkable. Many meetings, a few statements, and zero actions. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett called an emergency meeting of senior officials at the War Ministry headquarters in Tel Aviv, including War Minister Benny Gantz, Israeli Occupation Forces Chief of Staff Aviv Kohavi, and others to discuss, get this, Israel's options. In turn, Gantz held a situation assessment session with Kohavi and the head of the Israeli Occupation Forces Operations Division, Oded Basyuk, in addition to the head of the Intelligence Division, Tamir Heyman, devoted to discussing Israel's practical options to respond to Hezbollah's retaliation. However, no results came out of the meetings, paralleled by Israeli field withdrawals, indicating the limitations of Israel's options. Perhaps what was mentioned in Gantz's call with his American counterpart, Lloyd Austin, although the call was pre-planned and initially not related to Hezbollah's response, was remarkable in its implications. According to Zionist media, Gantz said during the call with Austin that, quote, Israel is asking the international community and the United States in particular to demand the Lebanese government to stop firing rockets at Israel, end quote. This demand was sufficient in its implications, notably that the Israeli occupation is requesting its American buddies to get involved to stop Hezbollah's retaliatory rockets instead of taking the usual aggressive matters into their own hands. Hence, in addition to Hezbollah's success along with its allies in thwarting the new Middle East plan by confronting its Lebanese and Syrian tools, it is now more than evident that Hezbollah has also succeeded since the great 2006 victory in thwarting this same plan by confronting its Israeli tool at the Lebanese gate towards Palestine.
Now we are back at the Mideast stream with Radwan Murtada, veteran journalist at Lebanese Al-Akhbar, a daily newspaper. Now, Mr. Radwan, the task seemed not easy for Tel Aviv in the wake of Hezbollah's response. Its decision was moving between two limits here. It wants a response that does not lead to losses on the Lebanese side so as not to cause retaliation, but at the same time, it sought some sort of an attack in a way that would not lead to an escalation that would further be increased into a confrontation. How can Israel achieve any results, if I may, when it's stuck between these two extremes?
Israel
tries to remain within these two edges, or these two extremes, or tried in its last attack to be between these two extremes. This was uncovered with the comments of the commentators who were close to the Israeli army, but it's clear that Israel has failed. Israel expected that Hezbollah will not retaliate because Hezbollah is in crisis, but even after the retaliation, there was more than international mediators. UN mediators, they've delivered the message that to the Lebanese side that the issue is open. Now, what if the issue developed and Israel made a mistake and there were no asymmetric or similar retaliation? What if Israel made a mistake that caused larger retaliation? Would things stop there, or would things develop into a confrontation? It is my opinion that Hezbollah, Israel is not ready to this confrontation, but and Hezbollah does not want it, but if it was imposed on Hezbollah, Hezbollah will engage in it.
Well, after the 2006 victory, it was always present in Israel's calculations whenever it was considering the option of war, at least confrontation against Hezbollah. The latter's developed capabilities, their tactics, their missiles, which are, by the way, established by the resistance and were proven to be valid in combat, whether it was in Syria or in Iraq. If the shadow of the 2006 war changed the equation of the conflict with the Israeli enemy, what do you think last week's resistance retaliation brought forth to the whole regional confrontation with Israel?
Since the year 2011 and after the events of the so-called Arab Spring, the Islamic resistance of Hezbollah has engaged in a huge military experience in Syria and in Iraq and acquired huge expertise in this regard. Israel was viewing this with concern and regarded that this experience will be reflected or maybe repeated in any confrontation or battle in the future, especially as Hezbollah, on more than one occasion, the Secretary General of the party threatened Israel that in the next coming confrontation, we will go into the Galilee. But in spite of all that is being said, Hezbollah says we only want to liberate our land. We will observe the drone border. But if there is any aggression, we will retaliate to that, and we will keep maintain supporting the Palestinian resistance. The recent retaliation was to re-establish this equation of deterrence. Even if Hezbollah with its complete military, Hezbollah needs to re-establish and to consolidate this deterrence equation, that even whatever has changed, even the economic crisis, will not change anything in our plans in the as far as the confrontation.
Well, something very interesting happened at the end of the mission, where a group of Shwaya residents in Hasbaya in South Lebanon shared a video of themselves surrounding a truck carrying a missile launcher and arresting and harassing as well the fighters, the resistance fighters who were riding in the truck and in the car accompanying it after they finalized their mission against the Israeli entity on the border with Palestine. That was a very unpleasant precedent that brought condemnation from all across Lebanon. Who's to say that this won't happen again in other villages where at least there are a couple of groups that are anti-Hezbollah, or at least who's to say that this will not be the way to ignite Lebanon all over again?
First, what happened in Shwaya was not the first time it happened, because during the July confrontation, there were vehicles of the resistance that were intercepted. But what happened in Shwaya has some dangerous signs, meaning the way of attacking the resistance fighters and taking the footage and claiming that the resistance is firing from civilian areas. And Israel hurrying to, rushing to accept it and take this and to say that the environment of Hezbollah is rejecting Hezbollah and they are opposing its actions. But there is one positive lining that some of the Shuwaya people had their head, two or three of the resistance fighters, they were hidden, and the people from Shuwaya, so part of the Shuwaya residents were against what happened and the attack against the resistance. So the question was, said Hassan Nasrallah, what if this happens again? So Sayyid Nasrallah said that they need to be taken to court. Their names are there, their images are there, photos are there. And also he expressed how much he was affected or impressed by what happened, or affected emotionally. He's saying that if the state does not take action in this regard, meaning when the state shows negligence, we will see what needs to be done, because those who launch aggression, aggress against the resistance, are as if collaborating with the Israeli enemy. It's clear that it is a pure political accusation. It is clear that there's a sort of operation room that are trying to promote this accusation, because the Lebanese forces and the Lebanese Kataib are the ones accusing Hezbollah in this regard. And some media outlets try to promote this. But as long as, since the Americans, and they are the number one enemy to the Hezbollah, the French, the British, and the Lebanese authorities, they are all say unanimously that there was no external aggression. It was not because of an explosive bomb. And there was nothing other than the material that was stored in this section of the port. So this shows that Hezbollah has nothing to do. When he was criticizing Bitar, the judge who's investigating this, he was saying, declare whatever you have. So some say that the justice is slow as a turtle, but others say no, the justice that is slow is one that is not incomplete, because it allows the accusation of innocent people. As for the nitrate issue, to say that these nitrates were to Hezbollah, to Syria, sorry, there is no need to say this, because Syria can produce these and manufacture these nitrates. It is something that they were used by the militias in Syria that were against the regime, and reports show that jihadists were using these materials, because it was difficult for them to get to DMT and S4 and everything like that. So why would Hezbollah, the Syrian regime, go to something that is used in agriculture in order to use it as a weapon?
Well, I want to thank you very much, Radwan Murtada, veteran journalist at Lebanese Al-Akhbar daily newspaper, for joining us to discuss the ongoing developments in Lebanon, especially the new development of Israel targeting Lebanese territory with an air raid after 15 years of total deterrence. Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Ring.
In the limelight.
The remarks of the Chinese envoy to the UN that the United States is the biggest threat to peace and stability in the South China Sea, not to be looked as a crisis pertaining to a particular geographical area. It is actually part of a grave problem plaguing the whole world, in view of the fact that
The United States is evil to its very core. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Keihan International. This article is published under the heading, The United States, the stabilizing factor all over the world. Stay tuned for more.